Shrink Wrap Radio number 882, Michael Tierno on psychedelics, transformation, and sacred sexuality.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Michael Tierno, MA, and we'll be discussing his work as an expanded states of consciousness guide and ayahuasca retreat leader in Peru. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Michael Tierno, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Dave. I'm happy to be here. I'm not a doctor. I don't have a PhD. I have two master's degrees, but thank you for calling me doctor.
Okay. Somewhere I got that idea. I wasn't sure. I should have double-checked with you, but
Still be in the cards. I have like three PhDs in my head that I want to do. So
yeah, okay. So it might well be in the cards. Well, let's find out a bit about your background before we get into your work with expanded states of consciousness. Maybe you can tell us a bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Francisco. Interestingly, I was always interested in, well, when I was younger, like when I was in high school and stuff, I was always interested in sort of esoteric things, and in psychology and consciousness. I took, AP psychology, and I was determined to, that I already knew what I wanted to do in life. I was going to be a clinical psychologist like yourself, but I wanted to work in academia. And, I went on that path, through undergraduate at, UC Santa Cruz. Interestingly, something that was had a profound impact on me when I was in UC Santa Cruz. I don't know if you've heard of David Chalmers and you know the hard problem of consciousness. My girlfriend at the time, who later ended up being my wife and mother of my kids, was his intern, and so she was copy-editing his book while, and so I was learning about these kind of philosophy of mind sort of concepts, my 18, 19, 20 years old. And I've had that hard problem with consciousness in my head throughout the rest of my life. I ended up, when I left undergraduate, I went into a PhD program at Ohio State for social psychology. I just found social psychology as I learned more about the diverse field of when you're in high school, you think of clinical psychology. You're taking a bunch of additional psychology courses, realize the expansiveness of what is the psychological field. And so I really resonated with social psychology, went to the Ohio State University, started a PhD program there, finished a master's degree. And I was really focused on consumer psychology. Let me turn on this light, look a little better. Consumer psychology. And so I learned that I could get an MBA for free by just laterally moving to the within the graduate school. And so I went and got an MBA in marketing international business with the intention of going back and finishing the PhD. However, I started doing an internship at a pharmaceutical company and got captured by love of money and not living like a student. So uh-huh. I left academia, worked for a pharmaceutical company for 5 years, then ran a business in California for almost 20 years. And then about 8 years ago, I, rediscovered altered states on a trip to Peru. Ayahuasca changed my...
Before we go there, I can see how I got the idea that you had a PhD because you were enrolled in that PhD program. And what year did you graduate from high school, if I may ask?
91.
Okay, yeah. So that was there was a lot of information about consciousness out there, and people were writing about it and so
Yeah,
on. So I can see how,
absolutely.
yeah, I
Yeah,
can see
in
how
fact,
you would have
the
got
book that David Chalmers wrote came out in 95 or 96, right when I was graduating from undergrad.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his name, but I'm sure it was a good book. And there were so many books coming out around that time, and a whole excitement about consciousness. What was your home life like?
My home life.
Yeah.
Both my parents were immigrants from Spain. And
Okay.
life was actually quite good. Had supportive and loving parents. They child of the 70s and 80s, so it wasn't as hands-on as it is now. But I had a lot of freedom. As long as I didn't get into trouble, my parents kind of let me do what I wanted. But I always felt that they had my back. I always could come to them for help and support. I felt a lot of love from them throughout my upbringing. The Spanish culture is very affectionate. So we always kissing each other, which is not
Yeah.
common in the States and this thing. So I had
Yeah.
a lot of affection from my parents and a lot of care from them. We did things every weekend as a family. It was I would say it's a good, it wasn't perfect family life, but I mean, I don't think a perfect home life is necessarily good in terms of people being able to be resilient in real life, when they become adults. So
Yeah.
I was blessed. Am blessed.
Pardon?
I was and am blessed by being
Blessed,
by my
yes.
parents that I had
Yeah,
and have.
that's great. Did you learn to speak Spanish or not?
I speak Spanish fluently,
Ah,
and
excellent.
I speak with a Castilian accent. So people often ask me, "Are you from Spain?" I can tell that American
Yeah,
Spanish.
I studied Spanish in high school and in college, and actually went to Spain for a little while, and it always felt awkward to do the TH sound that many of the Castilian Spanish is distinguished by, as opposed to, I grew up in LA, so I grew up hearing a lot of Mexican Spanish,
Right. That's right.
and so it took a while to just switch over.
I don't know if you know Argentinian Spanish, but Argentinians speak an entirely different sort of way. They like the double L is pronounced like SH, and they speak a Spanish that was actually older than the Castilian Spanish.
Oh my
So
goodness.
in the it's a Spanish, it's kind of like speaking Old English, but not quite as strong as you hear like they, thou, and all that kind of stuff. In Argentina, that some of their pronunciation is even more different than the distinction between Castilian Spanish and Northern Latin American Spanish.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
So you mentioned that you had some business. You started a business. What was the business that you started?
I owned and own a bakery in California, Northern California, San Francisco, and that was a mom and pop. We grew it into a pretty large wholesale operation, but all that is gone from COVID. So now it's just a little mom and pop store again, and I'm happy because I'm very grateful for that because it actually gave me the time over the past 4 years to really develop myself into what my passion and my life is, which is involvement with expanded states and supporting people and helping people. Because
Yeah.
as I mentioned, like my original thing was to be a clinical psychologist because it was a desire to help people. And I went away from that path for many years, or helping people in that way wasn't part of my life. And then through COVID and through the kind of decrease in the brick and mortar style wholesale business gave me space to like really embrace what I find more interesting, find my passion, my purpose in life.
Yeah. So, you one of the things that you say about yourself, and I think this is a result, this is edging into your going to Peru, You say for a long time you were a staunch materialist. How so? What do you mean by that?
So, you know, as part of, you know, learning, you know, academic psychology, there's a base sort of understanding that, you know, there's still a big flavor of behaviorism. There's still a big flavor of, you know, of the other sciences, and psychology oftentimes, you know, is trying to like defend themselves to say that they are as sciencey as like biology and chemistry and physics and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
So there's sort of a implicit and maybe explicit understanding that we are just a collection of, you know, physical particles that come together, and like we're in a behavioral sort of mechanistic manner interacting and engaging in the world. That at base there's only material, there's only physical stuff, and you know, one of the theories is that, you know, consciousness emerges from the physical somehow. Who knows? Strong emergence, weak emergence. There's different sorts of understanding of that. And I was a very staunch materialist. Like I believed, like, oh, there is only matter. There is only this physical world. And I was pretty well vetted in the argumentation for that. And so I was kind of militant in that, and a little bit embarrassingly so, because after I went to Peru and experienced ayahuasca, I had to do kind of like a oops, that was maybe there's more to this life than just atoms and quantum fields. Maybe the metaphysics that is at base reality is different from how I had learned it from an intellectual sense, because now I was experiencing something that was different, that was more whole, that was more real. And since then, I've done a lot of reading and research into different metaphysics and philosophy of mind, and, you know, have new beliefs.
Yeah. How would you describe your new belief? Is there a term that captures it, you know, that would be the opposite of a staunch materialist?
Absolutely. There is. I didn't know we were going to be talking about this, but I do love talking about this. So I hate to say this. So materialism suffers from something that I mentioned earlier, the hard problem of consciousness, which is how does our experience, consciousness just basically, our experience of the world, the color of a strawberry, the taste of a strawberry, the feeling of love, the, you know, everything that is that we can experience when we open our eyes and see the whole of existence and before us, everything we're listening to that's impinging on consciousness. And materialism has yet to have an explanation as to how this consciousness can arise from something physical. That's called the hard problem of consciousness that I was
right.
So the hard problem. The easy problem is like correlating brain states with like some, you know, some kind of conscious pattern or some kind of experience. But those are all correlations. No one has yet found a causal relation between the physical and to the conscious. So that's the big problem with physicalism. I didn't think it was a problem at the time, but I just figured we will eventually figure out how these things come together. I then embraced something called panpsychism, which is the idea that consciousness is a fundamental part of matter or part of particles, so that everything has some little bit of consciousness to it, right? So it's physical, and it also, everything physical also has like a layer of consciousness that's attached to it, that's intrinsic, that is part of it. That's panpsychism. Probably the most popular proponent of panpsychism today is Philip Goff. He's a English guy, very well spoken. And that also has suffered some problems. Like, how do you get our rich experience from a collection of little experiences, of conscious experiences? It felt more real to me, you know, it felt like, oh, well, at least we're embracing this idea of like consciousness existing, but there's still a lot of problems with it. Like my mind couldn't grok like exactly how this was kind of like the ultimate sort of metaphysics. And then in the last like year and a half, I discovered something that is not a new metaphysics. It's not new to philosophy of mind, but has more recently been well articulated again. Started with, I guess, Kant and Schopenhauer and Jung, but this is a philosophy called idealism. And this just absolutely dismisses with the idea of the hard problem, because it says that matter is just what the world looks like through our perceptual apparatus, but really everything is actually mental. Everything is only consciousness. And that is aligned with, and there's, you know, it aligns with the empirical data, as I understand it to be, and it aligns with a lot of with the experience of expanded states of what happens to the brain when we're on a psychedelic, for example. And it feels more correct. It's in alignment with some spiritual traditions like Advaita Vedanta, the Hindu tradition of that, you know, Brahman and Atman, and we are an Atman that's witnessing the universe from a different perspective. It's just in alignment with so many things. It just feels more correct to me. It feels more embodied for me. It satisfies many of my metaphysical questions. And it's actually taking on a lot of traction, this idealism perspective, both in foundations of physics and in neurobiology. There's people have been arguing about this stuff for years and years. And then, you know, yeah, as people, we're not exposed to it.
Yeah. So in 2016, you end up going to Peru, and you've already foreshadowed that you end up taking ayahuasca. How did you happen to go to Peru? How did that come about?
It's kind of a funny story. I didn't plan on going to Peru. I was my wife and I were kind of in a rocky place. We were running a business together, living together, socializing together, and we saw a counselor of sorts, and she said that she tasked me with doing something that was by myself, to separate myself so I can have something that I own. And my first idea was to go to the Philippines and learn how to kite surf. That's what I wanted to do. And then my wife at the time said she wanted to kite surf also, that if I was going to kite surf, I had to do it with her, which was a blessing because
I'm missing that word. You wanted to do what?
Kite surf. Kite surf. You see him in the bay.
Oh, kite. Yeah. That looks. If I were younger, I would have gotten into that as well.
Right. Yeah. So that's what I planned on doing, but through circumstance, she suggested that we do that together. And through a series of events, I talked to a friend who said, "Let's go to the Andes and go rappelling down into the jungle." And then when I looked into that, he backed out of it. But through my research about the Andes and Peru and Ecuador, I learned about this stuff that wasn't so well known at the time, which was ayahuasca. And I said, okay, well, I don't think anybody here wants to do ayahuasca with me. So I ended up saying, I'm going to go to Peru and do ayahuasca. I felt this calling, this like pull to do it. It was kind of a weird situation. I felt like this is really what I'm called to do, to have this experience. And I went to Peru and I did ayahuasca, had a very intense first half of my first experience was very intense, very scary, very challenging, followed by one of the most powerful mystical states that I've had since then. Changed my kind of, my come to Jesus moment that this materialism thing wasn't what I thought it was, that there was maybe more to reality than what I was giving myself permission to understand.
So you say initially the first impact of the ayahuasca was that it was scary and disorienting. And and then later somehow you moved into an appreciation of a mystical experience. Tell us about that transition if you can.
Sure. So this was my first ayahuasca journey some 8 years ago or so. And I sat with this guy, Paul Diamond, who's down in Peru. And I drank the cup and I thought, hey, this is going to be, you know, trust and surrender was what I've been told. And I was told that no matter what happens, these are key words, important words that I tell people as well. I don't serve ayahuasca, but I tell people when they're entering expanded state is that it will be over. You will come back. So I drink this, this cup and I sit down on my mat and I wait about 40 minutes and the experience of transitioning from one conscious state to the other is happening is I'm finding it very uncomfortable. I recognize, you know, my own internal need for quote unquote control, which is something that we all, many people kind of suffer. They think they have more control in their lives than they do. So I'm struggling with this transition of consciousness. There's all these images going by my experience. The room is dark. Eyes open, eyes closed, doesn't matter. I'm just seeing a pattern of wild things that I've never seen in my life. And I said to myself, oh, you've done it now. You've gone crazy. You're never coming back from this. This is the end. What a mistake you made. You're going to leave this retreat tomorrow. And then after about an hour of that, I the words of the person that was sitting it, which says, you know, if you find yourself in intense territory, just breathe and recognize, tell yourself that you're safe and recognize that you will, that we'll be sitting around in a group eating fruit in about 4 hours. So I told myself, I put attention to my breath, started slowing down. I started to appreciate my, put myself into the position of the witness and just watched what was going on, as opposed to like being like having myself invested in what I was seeing. And all of a sudden things calmed down and I felt a transition to an experience of being connected with everything in the universe all at once, which is, you know, part of the traditional, not the traditional, but the typical mystical experience that one gets under psychedelics, is that experience of oneness with everything, of connection with anything, of total love and gratitude for the universe and for life and for this gift of life that we've been given. I had that feeling and recognized that, whoa, this whole thing that has opened up in my conscious awareness does not seem like it's made of matter. It seems much more big and beautiful than I'd been able to appreciate or connect with before. And then the ceremony ended, and just like you said, we were having fruit all together as a group, and I was forever changed.
Yeah, wow. And was it challenging to integrate this into your life?
You know, it was challenging because there was two things that were challenging, really. So first was to be able to, having a community of people to be able to talk with about this experience, because and that's something that that people discuss in that have had these expanded states experience talk about, is that it's hard to talk about that experience of connection, divinity, you know, gratitude, ultimate gratitude, to people who haven't had that experience. They kind of think like, that's a freaking hippie, like what is he talking about? It's hard to find like-minded folks or folks that have had that experience. It's much easier nowadays, but it was, and it's easier in the Bay Area where I live. But it was back then, I was the only person I knew that had had any of these kinds of experiences in their 40s. And so I felt a little bit solitary. So that part was hard. The other part that was not hard, but it was a process that actually took me the next, you know, 6-7 years to do, was to kind of like unpack more and understand like how, you know, how much more there is to the universe than what I had allowed myself to understand and believe prior. Some things were very easy to integrate. So for example, I realized that I had this undercurrent of like some kind of shame that was just like an undercurrent that I was not aware of. And that came into focus, and that was like, and I was saying, well, why is this shame there? There's nothing to be ashamed of. What are you talking about? That just left. It was just gone. So, and some other sort of beliefs that I was like, what, you do this because of this, you know, idea that you had about this that came from childhood, like that just melted. There was nothing to integrate with regards to that. It was just bringing awareness to these parts of self that were outside of awareness, and those just dissipated. But the things that were challenging was, changing my metaphysics and adjusting into a world where my metaphysics was different and trying to understand that. And then finding community with people who had similar experiences. That was a work in progress. And only until like 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I'm sorry, only until it took like 5 or 6 years really to like get that real dialed in. So it's been a long process of integration.
Yeah. What about getting reintegrating with your wife, because you'd been so bonded, so close that, you know, the counselor had recommended that you needed to go off and do something separately, and this was very separate. So,
So that's an interesting story, and it's something that I think it's important to. It's important. It's a really important story. Thank you for asking this. When I came back, I was behaving differently. I was much more at ease with everything. I was not stressed out. I was much more at ease. I was more loving, more open, more vulnerable, all these kinds of things. And I had made these changes in my life. And I remember when my wife hadn't done any of these things, right? So she was still, she couldn't kind of like she, one time she told me, and it was like, she says, you seem different, but I don't believe it. You know, like she couldn't quite, she didn't understand what was going on. And so I think that one of the important things that, you know, I try and communicate with people who have partners is like, You both have to be doing the work. Otherwise, you're probably going to just apart if you're not both working on yourselves, individually. And she was not working on herself individually. I became more at ease with my life. I became more, not to say anything bad about her because she's a wonderful person, but I just, embraced this new path of mine, and we grew apart, and we're separated now, so for 4 years. Best thing that ever happened to me, because now I'm in a partnership that's completely different. We're both working on ourselves all the time and getting closer and closer as time goes on, which I think is the, the ideal, or what you want to be in relationship with another person, is to support each other, allow each other to be their best selves.
So, what's the role of psychedelics in the work that you do now? I know you are involved in leadership roles in terms of introducing people to expanded states of consciousness, and the way it worked for you was with ayahuasca. So, what's the role of psychedelics in your work now?
Psychedelics is one way that we can enter in an expanded state. And I work with, people who are, who are doing psychedelics, and people in other modalities as well, breath work and things like that. But the role is basically, like, I think there's like three sort of levels to this. So whatever expanded state, you could say, you could say psychedelics and different psychedelics are good for different sort of specific sort of things, but really, we could just talk about any expanded state. There's kind of three kind of levels that I like to think of. The first level is that first level of my first experience, which is emptying the vessel. Bringing awareness, self-awareness. These are lighter journeys, right? Bringing awareness to like core beliefs that don't serve us, maybe relationships that we're scared to sever or that don't serve us anymore. All this stuff that's hammering around in life that's sort of, we're not really aware of how it's impacting ourself, our being. And putting, bringing awareness to those things, and then allowing them to release them. For example, the shame that I was feeling that I didn't know where it came from. I had no idea this, but it was operating in my life. So, I'd go to a party and I'd have a couple drinks because I was trying to mask this shame that was not in awareness. I identified that there was some shame in there about something that I wasn't aware of, and all of a sudden I stopped drinking. It was just not, it wasn't serving me. So that's the first part, is emptying the vessel of that which does not serve. And that's lighter journeys, lighter expanded states done with breath work, connecting with oneself deeply in that way. The second stage is a deeper experience, which is if we haven't emptied the vessel, right, we still have all this stuff jumbling in our heads, it's very hard to surrender into a deep experience of an expanded state, an ego death experience, or a mystical state experience. It's hard to do that because the mind is still chattering. We don't want to surrender. We don't want to give up control. But once you've emptied the vessel, future states, we can like get close to remembering who we really are, which is an ego death experience, right? So ego being all those labels and stuff that we define ourselves in this world, but that really, and beliefs and all that crap, all that stuff that we picked up over our years, when that's less there and we can put that sort of to the side for a minute and have the ego death where we are just connected with our, our divine being, and we remember, because my clients don't usually think of this stuff as being new. They always talk about it in times. Oh, I remember who I really am. I remember that I'm here for this stuff. I remember that life's not such a, torment of a big deal. I can, okay, I can go. That's okay. Clarity. So remembering who they really are, and then they come out with much more ease, like I did after my first ayahuasca experiences in the world. And with ease, they get less triggered by things. They're able to respond rather than react because they've remembered that they are a divine being, that they are connected with the rest of the universe in one, field of consciousness. And then the third part is life does get hard, and we forget again that, our divinity. We forget that, that we don't need to take that we don't need to take things quite so seriously, that life is a game. We forget that again. And then, so I call that third phase going back to the well. So you go back and have another experience this time. Oh, I remember again. Okay, back to the work, which is the real work. The ceremony starts when the ceremony ends. So your life is the real work. When you sit with me for a few hours, that's where we're going to kind of like reorient ourselves. And then when we go back to life, it's like when we actually are doing other living, because that's the important part, is to like, if it has an impact on your life, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, good answer.
Yeah, reminds me of that Zen saying, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly right. Yeah. You know, some people get all involved, not very many, very few people get all involved. They're chasing more and more of the expanded states experience, not realizing that we're here to live. You know, we're here to love. We're here to learn. We're here to like find meaning in life. We're here to experience all that life has to offer. And that's really what we should be striving for, I believe.
Yeah. So one of the risks that you're alluding to then is trying to chase the experience, trying to recreate that experience. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm reminded of the title of the book that's always meant a lot to me, You Can't Go Home Again, which to me is saying, and there's a Zen expression too, you can't get into the same river twice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's very rare, that people chasing the dragon that way is very rare, because, you know, most of the people that I've spoken to that I know of that have done, you know, even the people like myself who have done ayahuasca, I've done ayahuasca, I don't know, 40 something times. I'm always anxious to take that cup. I'm never like, oh, I can't wait to do that. It's always like, okay, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's always with a little trepidation and definitely respect. And that I do that. I'm not trying to chase anything. You don't know what's on the other side of the envelope, what's on the other side at any time. And sometimes they're, you know, intense experiences, and usually they're wonderful, but you know, it's always a challenging experience to some extent.
Yeah. So you say you've done it 40 to 50 times with ayahuasca. That's a lot.
Over 8 years. I mean, I have friends in Peru that have done it hundreds of times because they facilitate retreats and they're drinking. You know, traditionally when you're facilitating retreat with ayahuasca, you're drinking with the group. Everybody drinks with the group.
See.
So I've done hundreds of times.
Yeah.
No ill effects. The thing that does get easier is over time is to actually surrender to the experience and just have the experience and not get attached to things needing to be the way you want them to be, but the way that they are.
In something that you sent me, you talked about the differences in utility between ketamine, MDA, psilocybin, and ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. What are you getting at there?
Sure. Well, these are all different. This is all a little more technical, but so there's kind of like ketamine is the it's not really a psychedelic, but it's the dissociative anesthetic that is legal right now in the United States for helping people with treatment resistant depression, anxiety, PTSD, whatnot, and it's sort of the least effective in terms of you don't just have one experience that then really shatters and changes your life. There's a schedule. You have to do it often. It's kind of palliative. So it kind of like just gives you some peace so you can go forward, and then you have to do it again. So usually a schedule for ketamine at a ketamine clinic is like you do it once every 2 weeks for a month or so or 2 months, and then you do it once a month. You sort of taper off as you get more embodied into that sort of that peaceful state that the ketamine gives you. And there's therapy involved with that, the impact thing, but it's not quite as deep as, for example, MDMA or psilocybin. MDMA has the property of decreasing the fear center. People oftentimes go to a rave or a party and they do MDMA and they fall in love with somebody immediately because it's something that MDMA, a quality, it's called an empathogen. It gives people the ability to see another in the other's best light. So everybody looks like amazing, you know?
Yeah.
And so when MDMA in sort of a therapeutic setting and you have the eye shades on, who are you relating to and seeing that person in their best light? You're relating to yourself. So now you see yourself, you know, the same way that somebody at a rave with other people, you see yourself with self-love, with compassion, gratitude for your life. And you're able to look at the things that might have triggered you in the past and realize, oh, really, that's part of the past, and kind of see it from a different frame, and enter into a new relationship with yourself. Self-love is probably the most important first kind of factor of emptying the vessel, is realizing like, wow, I have this life to live. So you look at yourself with that self-love, and that carries forward. Then you get psilocybin, which actually has the, quote unquote, hallucinogenic properties. You can have a full ego death, so it's much more powerful of a medicine. So you can see yourself without all the trappings of ego, enter in that experience of oneness, connected with the whole universe as it manifests and unfolds through time. It definitely is a more challenging experience, right? So it's kind of more than the MDMA or the ketamine, and then finally you have IO. And sorry, getting back to psilocybin. Psilocybin is, emotional, mental, maybe spiritual. Ayahuasca is very similar to psilocybin, but it has these other two alkaloids, harmine and harmaline alkaloids. And something about ayahuasca actually, and I don't know how it works, but I felt it work. It actually, how we store trauma in the body. It goes into your body and cleans out the traumas that are stored in your body. And you purge them out. And sometimes there's not a whole cognitive reflection as to what's going on. You purge and just feel like the sense of relief, or maybe my arm doesn't hurt anymore, or my, kind of like works at the somatic level, which isn't so much the case with psilocybin, MDMA, ketamine. And then there's other psychedelics as well, like ibogaine, dimethyltryptamine, 5-MeO. We don't need to go into those. I don't know as much about those.
Yeah, and what about LSD? Where would you rate that?
LSD is very similar to psilocybin. The problem is LSD, it's a long haul. I've tried LSD in college, and you're talking about 8 to 12 hours.
Yeah.
People in the guiding community don't work with people who are on LSD or wanting to use LSD simply because of the length of time. If you're based for someone who's bringing their medicine and they're taking their medicine, you got 6 to 8 hours with them. If you're doing LSD, you're talking about 12 to 16 hours to have to sit with somebody. So it's just a different medicine. It's also similar in experience to psilocybin, but much more longer lasting, and there's a little bit of a different flavor of it, but it can be worked. They use it in the 50s and 60s in clinical settings for helping people heal.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate these distinctions that you're drawing, and it's a good boiling down, I think, of the differences. Another thing that you have been specializing in is teaching people about sacred sexuality. And so that sounds like a big topic. And so tell us about sacred sexuality and what you refer to as polarized relationships, and the difference between eroticism and sensuality.
Okay, wow, that's a big question.
Yeah, it is.
Let's start with the difference between eroticism and sensuality, because sensuality feeds into sacred sexuality. So eroticism, in my model, how I come to understand it, is all the mental trappings around the sexual experience, like fetishes, things like wanting things to be a certain mental titillation space, the ideas of sex, like someone likes to, I don't want it to get too graphic on the show, but someone's interested in like oral sex only. Like that's what turns them on, the mental part of it. There's an idea of it. And I think that the eroticism or BDSM or wanting to engage in polyamorous relationships, because they have this mental idea that there's not enough in one other person in their partner to satisfy their needs, or they are not enough. Satisfy their needs. These are all mental games that we're playing that are all of ego, and that's the field of eroticism, right? So the mental part of sex. Then you have the sensuality part of sex, which is purely based on the experiential nature of the sexual experience from like a pleasure point of view, from a somatic point of view, like what does it feel like? Whole body, whole embodied sex, you know, a whole embodied sexual experience where there's less mental going on and more, you know, how much pleasure can you give? How much pleasure can you receive? Not just in the genitals, but the whole body, the whole experience. Connecting with your lover in a way that you really understand her body, so that you know how she likes to be touched, how you can maximally provide pleasure for her, and how she can then understand how to maximally provide pleasure for you. And that is basically the dance of the sacred sexuality, where you're raising shakti, you're raising sexual energy, sexual pleasure in together as a unit, so that you can actually have an expanded state of consciousness. At a certain threshold of pleasure, you can actually, you know, some people say that it's actually dimethyltryptamine that's being released, that's endogenous in your mind, but you can have an experience that feels very much like, not quite as long, but feels very much like psilocybin or dimethyltryptamine, where you're actually seeing, you know, hallucinatory, or I don't think they're hallucinations. I think they're just something that we don't have access to. And that is just a different way of being. It involves real commitment and trust between both partners, and a longing to get to know each other better and to grow together. And that's what I think is, you know, where sacred sexuality comes from. One way, if you think of the Kama Sutra, right? You know, people think of it as like an erotic book of like pictures to show, but those pictures aren't of eroticism. Those pictures are to show you different positions to increase sexual energy. You know, we see them from the Western mind. Oh, look, dirty pictures, right? But they're not. They're actual positions. They're like positions to increase sexual energy and sensuality, right? And in these different positions, you have different energy chains. I don't know exactly. I haven't studied the Kama Sutra, but it's important to recognize it's not a dirty picture book. It's a manual for increasing pleasure. So that, I think, covers sacred sexuality to some extent, and sensuality and eroticism. And then we can go into polarized relationships. A polarized relationship is a relationship where one partner is primarily masculine. Of course, we all have masculine and feminine energies inside us, and the other partner is primarily feminine. And together they make a whole. The feminine has certain needs and desires that are different from the masculine partner. Right. So the feminine, you know, desires trust and safety primarily. Right. And she has all kinds of, you know, generally a she has all kinds of capabilities and characteristics that I don't have. Right. And then I primarily want to, as a masculine partner, want to feel useful and needed. I like to, you know, really feel that I am of service to my partner. When she's happy and I feel like I'm taking care of her, I feel good. Right. Because it just feels good for me. When she feels that she can really trust me, and then when she feels absolutely and totally safe around me, she can then open herself up and be her most authentic self. Because I give, you know, I'm allowing for that by really helping her, supporting her, and then not controlling in anything like that, like some people might think, but just allowing her to be as vulnerable as possible around me, and I too can be as vulnerable as possible around her. So that's the magic of the polarized relationship. If you think about a masculine person and a feminine person together in union, where they're able to express themselves and meet each other's needs, you know, as much as possible, you have kind of a whole. You have kind of like the yin yang, where you have the masculine, you know, the masculine side and the feminine side, you know, together to make a whole. So that's a very short version of explaining polarized relationships.
So people come to you for some sort of counseling services or guidance services. What are the delivery mechanisms of your business?
So I have three. First and foremost is one-on-ones. So I sit with people in an expanded state. They're in the expanded state. I sit with them. I make sure that they feel safe, that they're taken care of. I listen to them with total curiosity and absolute zero judgment, so that when they're in that more open state, they can feel comfortable, and I help them unpack what they're getting to, what they're alluding to, so they can really distill it, their long journeys. And then my third role in those one-on-ones is to extract and record as much information as possible from them so that they can then integrate it afterwards, right? So set the container, listen to them, and then help them recall afterwards what their experience is, what they want to bring to their life, afterwards.
Did you say you take notes or you make a recording or?
I take notes, and I'm a pioneer in taking a recording and transcribing it. So the deliverables that I give are, I don't know anybody, any other guides that give these deliverables. I'm teaching people, explaining people how to do this, because clients really appreciate having this long form, up to 160 pages of the narrative of what transpired, because you forget a lot of stuff in the expanded state when you come back to
Oh,
reality.
yeah.
And of course, the narrative, the transcript doesn't capture everything, but what it does is it gives you enough cues that when you're reading the transcript, you can re-remember what was going on in your mind for those things. Oh, yeah, I was thinking about my mom and all this kind of stuff, and like I need to do this and that and the other thing. So it's really, people have found it incredibly beneficial for the integration aspect, is to have these
Yeah.
transcripts and try
Yeah,
to.
I would think so. Yeah, that makes
Yeah,
a
I mean
lot.
that's what the thing is. And then I'm also recording notes, and then and my deliverable also to the client is oftentimes letter writing, affirmations, physical practices, meditation practices, different things that just come up as they come up, that I just give some suggestions for them to implement into their own life so that they can integrate the what they have. The second project I have is called Men of Integrity, and these are 4-day retreats with four different expanded state modalities. They're very intense. They're for headers at the moment. We only have them for men, and they are and they, it's 4 days. It's quite 4 days full of workshops and expanded states experiences and working together. And the brilliance about this, the thing that I'm most proud of and has the most impact, is once they graduate from the retreat, they are now enter into like graduate community or whatever. And then we continue to do once a month support calls. We have a study group. We're studying a book this year, one chapter a month. We're doing work on that. So there's a group of about 27 men in this group so far, and we hope to have about 50 or 60 by the end of 20 or by the middle of 2025. That's the Men of Integrity retreats. And the final thing that I do is I have a ayahuasca retreat center in Peru that I co-run with some of my friends down in Peru. That those are the people that have done ayahuasca hundreds of times. That is very important, because inevitably, especially when people hear about my own path, how I came on this path with ayahuasca, people start asking me like, what about ayahuasca? Unfortunately, most retreat centers, I know a lot of people in this space, most retreat centers aren't, things happen, right? They're made of people. I know everybody who works at Heart Sanctuary. I trust everybody down there with anything. I know their families. I know, we're kind of a family down there. And so I have to have a place where I can send friends, clients, where I have zero concern about how that place is being run, because at the end it's my that's on it. So I know how it's being run. I've been there a bunch of times. I've experienced it. We have 100% success rate with people being just blown away by it. There's no funny business. The ceremonies, which have been notorious with some of the, you probably read in the news that some unethical, sort of things happen with some clients, with some women clients, because the sort of cultural expectations for some of the indigenous tribes are not the same as our Western sort of ideas in terms of what consent is and whatnot on an altar state. And we're very, very, very straight in terms of like our rules and like how we proceed with ceremony and our integrity. And so I can send anybody down there and know that they're going to be, that they're not going to come back and tell me like, why did you send me? Like, they're going to be like, oh, that was amazing. And that's critical, that Heart Sanctuary Retreats, which is what it's called, that I have that place down there that I can send clients and friends to without any kind of qualification or without
Yeah.
any concern.
Yeah,
So those are the three things.
that's as I appreciate the ethical concerns that you bring to that. Now,
It's critical, Dr. Dave, because when people, these are very vulnerable states that people are in.
right.
If and they're at their most vulnerable, and unfortunately, there's a, there's an increased likelihood that they could be taken advantage of. And so, I think that the ethical integrity of a retreat center and of a guide and whoever you're working with has to be the most important thing, because in the end, they're the ones that are setting the container for you. They're the ones that are responsible for your safety. Make sure that things are being run according to some sort of standards. And so it's incredibly important.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to get across here that you hoped would come out in this interview?
No, a lot of stuff came out that I wasn't planning on talking about. I
Good.
wasn't talking about it. So
Good.
that was fun.
That's supposed to happen.
Oh, fun.
I guess you would be considered an underground, would you say an underground therapist, an underground guide?
I'll just call myself an expanded state guide. I'm gonna say underground or anything like that. A lot of this has to do with who provides the medicine. So if you don't provide the medicine, luckily in the Bay Area, there's a lot of places where you can, there's kind of dispensary models where you can go and get your own medicine. So I don't
Yeah.
have to, that sort of thing. People come with their own things. So I'm just, so it's not really underground. People, bring their own stuff. They're instructed on what they should get. They go to the, where they got to get it. You can find it online. It's not difficult. I don't like to say that very much. Because I don't want people who are going to do this on their own, because that's a recipe for like a high risk thing, but it's not hard to find it. So the underground nature of this is less underground than it might have been some years ago, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I re really appreciate all that you've shared, and I appreciate learning about the ethical considerations that you bring to your work. And so I think that's really important. So, master, rather than doctor, I'll call you Master
Sure.
Michael Tierno. Thanks for
Mike,
being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
thank you very much. I wanted to tell you I'm so inspired by you having done this for, close to 1,000 interviews over 18 years and just like powering through. And I admire you, and I admire how much knowledge you must have gained from interviewing, literally hundreds and hundreds of people over these last 18 years. Good on you.
My recent guest, Michael Tierno, MA, was a delight to interview. About 8 years ago, he felt drawn to travel to Peru to take ayahuasca. Growing up in San Francisco and then attending college at UC Santa Cruz, he was no stranger to psychedelic substances, but mostly in a recreational or casual context. He enrolled in a doctoral counseling program, but dropped out from the full doctoral program, accepting a master's degree for his trouble. He felt he was wasting his time and decided to go into the family bakery business and make some money. He was in his 40s when he decided to act on the impulse to go to an ayahuasca retreat in Peru. The ayahuasca experience really rocked his world. His studies of psychology, both as an undergraduate and doctoral student, had firmly molded him to embrace a rational materialist conception of the universe. His ayahuasca experience suggested a far more complex view of reality and led to a profound personal transformation. Part of that transformation propelled him into his right livelihood of becoming a spiritual guide. I might have greeted his claimed transformation with a degree of skepticism, but as we discussed his work, I was impressed by his commitment to ethical practice and the degree to which he has educated himself about psychedelics and their spiritual and healing potential. I was also impressed by his ability to clearly articulate his own ayahuasca experience and to categorize the properties of other psychedelic substances, including ketamine, MDMA, psilocybin, and LSD. His integrity was furthermore underscored when he corrected me for referring to him as a, quote, underground guide. He pointed out that he does not provide the psychedelics for the people who consult with him individually. Also, he emphasized that he does not always employ psychedelics in guiding his customers to expanded states of consciousness. In addition to his personal one-on-one guidance, he also offers a four-session men's retreat with follow-up and refers seekers to the Ayahuasca Center in Peru, which he co-owns. If I were in the market for the sorts of services Michael Tierno is offering, I would trust him.
Dear Dr. Dave, dear Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, hello from Istanbul, Turkey. My name is Yücel Ersöz, an avid listener of Shrink Wrap Radio. Now, I'll continue to speak with my foreign accent. It's more difficult to understand, and that's a good thing. You'll have to pay more attention, and at the very end, I'll be talking about important stuff. I'm not a psychotherapist, I'm not a psychologist, not even a faculty member at a psychology department in a university. In fact, I've only taken a single course in psychology in my entire life, which was Psychology 102. And don't ask me what happened to Psychology 101. After I graduated, I picked up my first psychology book after I was 40, which was only a few years ago. For 20 years, I've done nothing that has to do with psychology. So why am I listening to Shrink Wrap Radio? Because Dr. Dave and his guests are helping me answer a very important question. How do I become the self that I truly am? To appreciate all the efforts that Dr. Dave puts in, I thought the least I could do was become a sponsor. And that's exactly what I did. Now, here's the important stuff that I said I would be talking about. Folks, please pick up your laptops, crunch in the numbers, and be a sponsor so we can continue to share the wisdom around the world. It will only take a minute, cost you less than your average dinner, and buy you more soul food than you can ever imagine. Thank you all. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Yücel, there in Istanbul, Turkey, for becoming a monthly financial donor. It's great to hear from someone in your corner of the world, especially someone who is so passionate to live from his true self. And thank you for encouraging others to stand up and follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks to today's guest, Michael Tierno, M.A., for sharing his personal experiences and his work on expanding states of consciousness as a guide and ayahuasca retreat leader in Peru. Next week, I'll be speaking with Mayo Clinic Professor Stephen Whiteside, Ph.D., about his new book, A Parent's Guide to Treating Childhood Anxiety and OCD. Until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.